Good morning, everybody. Welcome again to Solomon on Blast. We have another great show for you again this week. We have a special guest in the second half hour that you don't want to miss. His name is John Winchester. He serves as the campus field organizer for Christians United for Israel. They have a special event coming up this week. We'll talk about that along with his views as to why Christians should support Israel. Remember, if you want to check out any of our past shows, you can find them on our website, SolomonOnBlast.com. If you want to stream us live, just go to PowerTalk1210.com or from your smartphone, get the PowerTalk 1210 app, and you can take us wherever you need to be. And if you want to talk with us today, the number, as always, 520-750-7456. You don't even have to give your real name when you call, especially if you're under the Witness Protection Program. Just call us, use another name. We have caller ID, so we can figure out who you really are. If you are in the Witness Protection Program, though, it's probably to keep somebody from finding out your real name or what your past is like. Solomon's wisdom tells us in Proverbs 22:1, a good name is to be chosen rather than great riches. What does Solomon mean by a good name is to be chosen? Is it our parents picking a good name for us at birth or us picking our own children's name? I'm not sure that's really the case anymore, especially in our confused culture today. When you hear some of the names celebrities give their kids, you know, you got to stop and think twice about ever listening to anything that comes out of their mouths. Kanye West and Kim Kardashian named their daughter North, supposedly because it means highest power. And with the last name of West, now her name's Northwest. Okay, I'm not sure I'd call that a good name. Nicolas Cage named his son Kal-El. If you don't know, in Superman comics, that's Superman's birth name. So Kal-El Cage. Again, not sure that's such a good choice. Anyways, in the Jewish culture, given names were significant. If you consider Solomon's name, the popular belief is that Solomon means peace, but according to what is supposedly the correct Hebrew translation, it really means recompense or fair penalty, which illustrates maybe a non-intuitive idea that bad results of something that was bad to begin with can still be good. And that's the whole David and Bathsheba thing. Solomon was good that came out of something that was bad to begin with. But a person's actual name isn't what Solomon's talking about here. He's really talking about what people think about you when they talk about you. What do people say about you when you're not around to hear? He's talking about having a good reputation and the fact that your reputation is worth a great deal. As he says, a good name is to be chosen or desired rather than great riches. Whether we like it or not, how people view us is significant. It is what creates our reputation. So what does it take to have that good name or good reputation? It's not something that happens overnight, nor is it something you can order from Amazon or download as an app on your phone. It takes time to build a good reputation. And it can't be you claiming how good a reputation you have. You can't create it by putting all the right stuff on your Facebook page, trying to prove how good you are or how you deserve to have a good reputation. It has to come from your actions and how others view your actions and behavior over time. It takes being diligent about doing the right thing over and over again for others to determine whether or not they believe you should be considered as having a good reputation. And it takes multiple people seeing the same diligence and the same behavior to build that reputation. Then those people will tell others, and that's where the good reputation really comes from. It comes as part of obtaining the wisdom that Solomon talks about in Proverbs. Solomon himself didn't obtain all his wisdom and wealth overnight. It took time for him. But once others saw his action, his fame spread to the point where the Queen of Sheba had heard all about it and came to see if it was true. She said to Solomon, "It was a true report, which I heard in my own land about your words and your wisdom. However, I did not believe the words until I came and saw with my own eyes, and indeed the half was not told of me. Your wisdom and prosperity exceed the fame of which I had heard." That's the kind of reputation we want to have. The problem is, though, a good reputation can disappear a lot faster than it takes to develop it. Kind of like those tall skyscrapers. It can take years to build them, but with a few well-placed charges, it comes crashing down in seconds. So we have to protect our reputation as carefully as we build it. Solomon's wisdom is clear on this also. Proverbs 25:6, he says, "A righteous man who falters before the wicked is like a murky in spring and a polluted well." That's not the kind of reputation you want to have. The whole concept of the Witness Protection Program may work right now in this world, but when it comes to having a good reputation in eternity, what are you going to do? Fortunately, there's a witness protection program for eternity. And that's to be a witness to the name of Jesus Christ here and now. That's the only name to have when it comes to getting into heaven, no matter what you've done. That's the name that's better than all the riches in the world. But it can be tough in today's world. We'll look at that when we come back after this commercial.
Never to come back.
We're back with Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. The stones say they're painting it black because that's how we kind of cover things up in the world, trying to avoid admitting that things aren't always what we want them to be. And in Ecclesiastes 8:12, Solomon says, though a sinner does evil 100 times in his day prolonged, yet surely I know that it will be well with those who fear God, who fear before him. And about a week ago, there was a meeting at the United Nations to address what's being referred to as the world's strange and immoral silence to the slaughter of Christians. And this particular address was done by a gentleman by the name of Rabbi Jonathan Cahn. He's probably best known for the book The Harbinger and The Mystery of the Shemitah. But he actually addressed the United Nations about a week ago, and he said that it's been 70 years since the concentration camps of the Third Reich were liberated, and in their liberation, the Allied forces forced the nearby townspeople to walk through those camps to face what the Nazis had been doing. And he says that most of those who lived in those towns and camps, it really wasn't unexpected. They knew that the Jews were being hunted down and taken into cattle cars and concentration camps. And he says the same thing is happening today across the world with regard to the persecution of Jews. And he gives some statistics in this particular address that are pretty eye-opening. And in his address to the United Nations, he's asking, why isn't the United Nations doing anything with regard to this? And the question is, why aren't they?
Well, you know, not to sound like a conspiracy person, but there seems to be a two-prong assault on Christianity in the world. And in the humanist West, it's an ideological attack that is quickly encroaching on the rights. You know, like we discussed last week, businesses to have Christian values and being targeted and that sort of thing, being targeted in the media, being called a hater. But in the third world, really the Muslim world mostly, you're seeing an actual physical assault. You're seeing physical violence and murder and mayhem. But if you think about it, I've always wondered, why do these two groups tolerate each other? Because on the face of it, you would think that a humanist would be completely repulsed by these ideologies, the way they treat women, you know, mm-hmm. the way they keep people back in the 7th century. And you say, how would they even be sympathetic in the least to that? Well, now we know what the common denominator is, Doug. The common denominator is Christians. And they both despise Christians.
Right. And in this article, in his statement before the UN, he said, in Indonesia, Muslims have put 10,000 Christians to death. That's just in Indonesia. India, 70,000 have been forced to flee their homes. Syria, 80,000 Christians have been, quote, what they call in Syria, cleansed from their homes. Now, he's not saying they've been killed, but they've been driven out of their homes. But there are numbers that are really shocking with regards to how many Christians are being persecuted and actually murdered. And he says probably more in the last 200 years than any time in history alone.
No, that's astonishing, when, especially when we think of all those paintings about the Christians in the Colosseum and the catacombs and all of those things. And you assume that Christian persecution was something that happened centuries ago and the mm-hmm. world has since left behind and saw the other people that are getting persecuted today. But these are astonishing figures. I mean, what did they say in another report that over 100,000 Christians are... What is it? No, over a million Christians have been killed between 2000 and 2010 mm-hmm. in the world. I mean, it's very difficult to even wrap your mind around that in today's culture.
And he refers to countries like Iran and Iraq, where there have been historically Christian communities since the biblical times. And I think the numbers it was either Iraq or Iran, 1.2 million Christians before 2000, and they're down to somewhere around 100,000 Christians in that country now. So there's a lot of persecution going on, but you don't hear that coming out of the United Nations and any kind of support from the United Nations, which is why he was there speaking in front of the entire United Nations.
Now, I remember being in Bethlehem a few years ago and asking a tour guide, at this particular point, it was a Palestinian Catholic, and I asked him how many Catholics lived in, or Orthodox Christians lived in Bethlehem, or what percentage, and he said at that time it was about 2.5%, but he told me not too many years before that, we're talking 25, 30, it was 25% of the city was Christian, and even said even before that it was much higher. It used to actually be one of the rare Christian towns in the Holy Land.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that there's just this dissipation happening. Many of the people flee, many of them become immigrants in other countries. But there's no question that there's something very sinister happening to Christians in this part of the world.
And he says in this address, he says, really what he's kind of trying to point out specifically is that there were a lot of people that just ignored the fact that 6 million Jews were being murdered by the Nazis, and we're doing the same thing all over again, that we have this viewpoint of, well, as long as it's not happening in my neighborhood, as long as I don't hear the screams, as long as I don't see the people getting killed, I'm not going to worry about it. So he's trying to really bring out the point that we're going to be held accountable, just like today. People can't imagine how in the world did Germans living in that area just ignore what was going on right outside their towns.
Well, again, there was an element of anti-Semitism 70 years ago and 80 years ago that was causing people to turn a blind eye. They did not want to think about what was happening to Jewish people because they were prejudiced against Jewish people in many Western cultures. Today, they do not want to acknowledge that Christians suffer. And it's something like, and probably behind, like then, when it comes to Christians, I'm sure behind a lot of people's thoughts are the attitudes that, well, good, let those Christians suffer. And in their minds, the Christians deserve to suffer for different reasons. And it's so ironic here, Doug. We talked about this woman, Bethany Cooper, who all those completely racist remarks
right.
about evangelical, white evangelical Christianity. You really analyze what she's saying and the people she's really talking about. The Christians getting killed in the world are not white evangelical Christians. The Christians getting killed in the world are people of color. They're those Nigerian students. They're mm-hmm. people in Middle Eastern extract of some sort or another. But the idea that this is just a white evangelical problem is I think that's one of the reasons why these people turn a blind eye, because they have a prejudice against that and they want to characterize everything that way.
Right. There was an article last week that was pretty disturbing that came out of Italy that they're actually looking at charging a group of Muslims who were trying to flee from Syria and I guess or Libya. They were crossing the straits there between Libya and Italy in a boat, and they threw 12 fellow passengers overboard, killing them. Now, this boat had a number of people on it. I think they said the original group of people was about 105. They left Libya in a rubber boat, so this has got to be a pretty good-sized boat. And they were making the trip across the Med, and they threw overboard 12 passengers. Why? Because they were Christians. They threw 12 of them overboard, literally murdering these people because they were Christians. And this boat was full of people that were fleeing Libya because of the persecution, because of the turmoil in that country. And yet you hear almost none of that. And he said the police from Italy said the 12 who died were from Nigeria and Ghana, which fits in exactly with what you're saying. It's very, very unlikely that those Christians from Nigeria and Ghana were white, right-wing, you know, supremacists that in any sense of the word.
And, you know, here's another element here that really is maddening. You know, whenever there's an event that takes place around the world, we are always told about the Muslim terrorists. It's like just the thing that just happened with Charlie Hebdo in France, for example, that these are not real Muslims. They're just people using the Muslim name, acting out their own violent intentions. You know, there's nothing to see here, folks. Keep walking. And every time these events happen, when someone says Allah Akbar and kills somebody, they're not real Muslims.
Right.
They're just people acting out in the
they're
name
extremists.
Of extremists. But we just talked about all these numbers. You pointed out in Iraq, I think, you know, for example, in 1.4 million Christians 100 years ago, today they have 200,000. So it's gone to one-seventh. So we're told these are not institutional problems within these countries, within these Muslim societies.
It's just small
nation.
Secular groups that
are
doing
that. Yeah, it's just these little guys acting out on their own. Now where do all these numbers come from? If it's just these isolated incidents that it's just happening because somebody took it upon themselves and he was misguided and he did some bad things. If that's the truth, then why are we seeing it nation after nation? You know, circumstance after circumstance that Christians are being persecuted, killed, beheaded. There's a heart-wrenching piece here in the article about the little Christian boys,
mm-hmm.
you know, being told to renounce Jesus. And they say, you know, Yeshua has always been there for us. And so these little boys were beheaded by ISIS.
Right.
I mean, little boys.
And these are young kids, 8-10 years old range. But you don't hear that in the news that this kind of stuff is happening. And it's happened continually. I mean, you can go back to World War II and Nazi Germany, but you can also go back 100 years. April happens to be the 100-year anniversary of the Armenian Genocide. And there was an article that the Turkish president, because it was the Turks, the Ottoman Turks, that were the ones that murdered about 1 million Armenians back in 1915. Well, the Turkish president has come out, and in one article, he lashed out at country leaders who have recognized the killing of Armenians by the Ottoman Turks as genocide. He stated that, and his name is Recep Erdogan from the Turkish president, he stated on Saturday, he accused France, Germany, Russia, and Austria, whose leaders or parliaments recently described the killings as genocide, of supporting claims constructed on Armenian lies. So he accused the United States of siding with Armenia, although President Barack Obama stopped short of using the term in his annual message. He said they should be first, one by one, clean the stains of their own history. So he's claiming that it didn't happen, and then in response he's saying, well, you got problems of your own. Don't point out my problems, even though he's already stated that they're not true. So it continually happens. It's happened 100 years ago with the Armenians. It happened 70 years ago with the Nazis. It's still happening today.
That's the scary thing about today, and we were talking about this, you know, in the other room there. But We have so much information that it almost cancels out any real information. You know, we seem to hit a tipping point.
Yeah, when there
all
is
information
no,
becomes virtual now. We don't know what's what.
There's no objective truth. Everything is subjective, and you can call it whatever you want, or you can't figure out what is and isn't true with the amount of information.
And so much of what we're getting in regards to these genocides going on in the Muslim countries against Christians, and we're constantly being told. I'm going to go back to this question. What do progressives in the West have to do with regressives in the Middle East? Where is their common ground? I'll say it again. Their common ground is that they are both anti-Christian, and that seems to really work for them right now.
Mm, absolutely. And the question is to everybody is, you know, will you stand by and just ignore what is going on? As long as we have our nice, comfortable situation here in the United States and it's only happening over there, can we just sit back and continue to ignore it? In the statement that he made to the UN, he says at some point in time, it's going to come and spread further around the world. And we may only see it, like you said, ideologically here in the United States right now, but what happens when it becomes more than just that? I mean, there's a lot going on if you've ever...
Well, one day, I'm afraid these two battle fronts are going to collapse on each other. Is that possible? In the West, we don't even see it. But remember the death camps that were liberated 70 years ago happened in the West. They didn't happen in the East. They happened in Europe. They happened in the most, at the time, cultured and advanced corner of human civilization. So to say that could never happen again in amongst civilized people is, it's putting our head in the sand, and that says it mildly. I think what we have to do as Christians today, we've got to make an issue out of it. We should be praying for these people. We should be talking about these people, and it needs to come up. And I admire Jonathan Kahn for making it an issue. I think he did an outstanding job with that.
Right, and so when we come back after this commercial break, we will have our special guest here in the studio, John Winchester. So we'll be back.
I could not foresee this thing happening to you.
We're back with Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. And we have in our One Greater Than Solomon segment, a special guest, John Winchester, City Director for Christians United for Israel, correct?
Yes, yes.
Welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here today.
Oh, my pleasure. Glad I could be here.
So give us a little background with what is Christians United for Israel?
Christians United for Israel. Well, it was actually started at the request of Benjamin Netanyahu. Several years ago, before he was prime minister, he had given a speech at the Knesset, and there's been concern in Israel for years about ensuring the U.S.-Israel relationship for the future. And so he invited Pastor John Hagee from San Antonio, Texas, to be there. And afterwards, he asked Pastor Hagee to start this grassroots network of Christians vocalizing their support for Israel and codifying it into and as using it as a reason to get out the vote and participate in government. And so it was really – there was a hunch that there are millions of Christians in the United States that support the U.S.-Israel relationship and support Israel. And so now in less than a decade, they're over 2 million strong. So it's they're the largest grassroots organization in the country.
That's the existing membership count?
Yeah.
For...
That's actually 2.5 or 2.2
million. Okay. Well, what's your background? How did you get involved in it?
You know, I'm born and raised here in Tucson. Went to the University of Arizona.
Wildcat fan?
Wildcats, all the way. Die hard. Yep. I don't even think about much of anything else in the sports world. I grew up four blocks from the university. I love it. I love the campus. I love everything about it. And I'm blessed to be working there now. But I grew up here. I went to a church. We supported Israel. We prayed for the peace of Jerusalem. We have an Israeli flag in our church. Had lots of warm feelings for Israel, but that was really the extent of it. When I was in graduate school, I was getting my master's in Middle Eastern studies. I was really not really attached to the Israel issue, modern Israel, or Jewish people at all. Really had very little contact with the Jewish people.
And your church didn't really focus much on the Jewish culture and that kind of thing?
Not really. Didn't really have those elements in our church. I mean, we had some. We talked about support for the Jewish people, but in terms of really taking a hard look at the Jewish roots of Christianity and stuff like that, never really did that. And my pastor saw Pastor Hagee on TBN talking about a conference in Washington, D.C., and it was their national CUFI conference, and he wanted people in our church to go, and he asked me particularly to try to make it. Ended up going, came back, started a campus group here at the U of A, CUFI at U of A, and just started engaging the campus on the importance of the U.S.-Israel relationship, why that's important. And I guess I did a good enough job. CUFI offered me a job. So did that for 3.5 years, and now I'm back home.
And you're still working at the U of A, though, at this point in time?
Yeah, I just got a job there in August. I worked for CUFI up until September 2013 and stopped doing that, had wife and kids. Traveling 90% of my time was not really feasible anymore. So came home, started working there at the university. I'm the outreach director for the Arizona Center for Judaic Studies, and they hired me on in August, and I've been there since. So very excited.
What was it that maybe that one event that really triggered your passion for the support for Israel?
You know, I remember what it was. Because I went to the conference in D.C., came home, and had lots of, again, some good feelings, really good feelings about Israel, but really getting passionate about it. My pastors asked us to do a kind of a pro-Israel concert, if you will. Our club on campus does music, and they asked us to do some music with kind of a Hebraic tone, and we were going to have educational materials about Israel and stuff like that on campus. And we decided we were going to go ahead and do that, and we did it, and we went all out. We tried to make it a really good event. We engaged a lot of people on campus. And right after we finished, some people came up to us and identified themselves as being Jewish and asked us if we were there for the protest. And I had no idea what they were talking about.
No idea. Was going to be a protest.
No idea. And I found out that afternoon that my department, Middle Eastern Studies, was bringing out a Holocaust, had sponsored a talk by a Holocaust-denying – he calls himself a rabbi. He's not recognized by any rabbinic institution in the world, but he calls himself a rabbi and Jewish man. And he was coming to the university to give a talk, but he's known internationally as being a Holocaust denier. And so
denier.
Yes.
And
so I was. So they said, "Well, you should come with us. We're going to go protest." So I thought I'll go to this and find out.
See what's up.
See what this is all about. And I got there, and there were so many people there that I knew from campus. I didn't even know they were Jewish. I didn't know anything about it. And they looked at me like I was a ghost. And they said, "What are you doing here?" You know? I said, "I was invited." And they're like, "We didn't know you supported Israel." And that's at that point, it got real. It got real because, you know, you can keep that inside you all you want, but until it reveals itself and makes an impact both in our community here, which has reverberations around the country, then it's really not something I can say I believe. So at that moment, I had been struggling with whether or not I was going to start a campus initiative here. But at that moment, I was like, all right, this is God. And yeah. I just dove into it.
When you realize that people have to say, wow, you're not representing what you say you believe, right?
It was kind of embarrassing because some of these people I had known for several years while I was at school, because I was in grad school, did my undergraduate at the U of A, and I was in grad school now. And several of the professors I had taken classes with were there, like, we didn't know you were pro Israel. So, you know, kind of a closet pro Israel supporter, realizing how important it was to be more vocal.
So, is the group making a difference, Christians United for Israel, at this point in time, do you think?
I think so. I mean, we're bringing out, we offer on-campus lectures and things like that, but really it starts with building relationships with people on campus, being salt and light in whatever environment we're in. And now we're at a point, especially as a city director, we have our Night to Honor Israel coming up here Tuesday at the Fox Theater at 7 p.m., Dennis Prager, but we have more participation this year than we've ever had. And the same thing was last year.
What kind of numbers are you?
Well,
did you have last year?
We had over 300. This year, we don't know. We had to move to a bigger venue because we were getting so many calls and people interested. And the Fox Theater holds 1,200. So we're hoping to fill that thing. I don't know if we will, God willing. But we've had, either way, I've seen more pastors in the last 6 months than I've talked to in probably all the five previous years combined. So there's a lot going on both in unifying the Christian body in Tucson as well as building relationships with people in the Jewish community. The Jewish Federation of Southern Arizona, which is a major organization and piece of our community here in Tucson, they're sponsoring the event. Stu Mellon is the CEO president. He's going to be present as well as participating in the program. And we're building strong relationships within the Christian community and within the Christian Jewish community. I think it's not just going to benefit the Israel relationship, but it's going to benefit Tucson. It's going to have incredible impact. So
now, can I change gears here just a little bit? You mentioned Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Yes.
So just to kind of just move into this, just straight into this. What do you think about his visit to America a couple months ago and how that affected his reelection?
Okay, first of all, there is nobody who can address the threat of Iran to the world better than Benjamin Netanyahu. His speaking ability as well as his knowledge of the region, of course he lives there.
Right.
It's his neighborhood. It's not ours. There's nobody who speaks on it better. I was a little concerned with the acceptance of the speech because I felt like Speaker Boehner gave it to him as a political maneuver. So I was and still am worried about the context of his speech, but there's nobody who speaks better on the Iran threat to the world. We're talking about Iran's nuclear capabilities, but who's talking? Why aren't we talking about Iran's terrorism that they and acts of terrorism that they've been perpetrating against the United States for well over a decade? There's just so much more to the conversation than Iran having nuclear weapons that I think it was a beautiful speech. Absolutely.
Yeah, fantastic.
It was inspirational as well as just informative. I thought he just did a fantastic job on it.
Well, the line that he made, and I'm paraphrasing, he said something to the effect of, with or without your support, you know, Israel will stand. Israel will go on. I thought that was an electrifying statement.
They have to. You know, we'll waffle, but I'll be honest with you. The United States hopes Israel will do it. The United States is hoping deep down in their heart, the State Department is hoping that Israel is going to go ahead and pull the military trigger and take out the reactors because we don't want to have to deal with fallout with Iran or with Russia. We're not even worried about Iran. Iran, militarily, they're not going to attack us. The worst that they're going to do is continue terrorism. They can't militarily attack us if we were to take out their nuclear reactors. We are worried about Russia. Israel is not worried about Russia. Israel does not care because the very life of their nation is at stake.
So you don't think Russia is a threat to Israel in any way, other than maybe indirectly through their support of Iran?
The relationship of the United States, I'm not saying that, but what I am saying is that the nature of the relationship between the United States and Russia is very different than the nature of the relationship between Russia and Israel. We have a history, a lot of history with Russia,
absolutely,
recent history with Russia that Israel does not have. In fact, when Israel was formed as a nation, things have changed quite a bit. Russia actually was casting a yes vote for the formulation in the UN Security Council for support of the nation of Israel. So Russia's relationship with Israel is very different. And if you can look at it like this, if we were to attack Iran, Russia would take that as we are attacking their proxy,
mm-hmm,
which they will see as a direct attack. If Israel were to attack Iran, Israel's seen as taking care of a business with a direct neighbor,
right,
as opposed to a proxy.
Okay. Well, hold those thoughts. We'll be right back with more of Solomon on Blast right after these messages. Okay, we're back here on Solomon on Blast. In our One Greater Than Solomon segment, we have John Winchester with us. We'll continue the discussion. He's part of the Christians United for Israel group here in Tucson. And we were talking just before the break there about Netanyahu's speech and how it really impacted the United States. What's your viewpoint with regards to President Obama and the whole Iran deal? Do you think that it was kind of an attempt to counteract the whole
thing? I think he was definitely trying to take back control. Policy is slipping through his hands. He is seen by most of the Middle East as a very weak leader. Of course, they believed that. I think there was an article published in 2010 talking about how the Arabs preferred President Bush's strength and leadership in the region, even if they disagreed with his policy, over Obama's softness. He's always been seen as a weak leader by the Middle East, Middle East counterparts, our allies, those who are not our allies. But I do believe that this piece here, although I don't know, some of it, I think the timing was reactive to what was happening in the Senate, but the House of Representatives and Congress. But also, I also believe that this is something that he's probably had in the works for a long time. His chief advisor is Valerie Jarrett. She's Iranian and self-proclaimed Muslim, just based on some speeches that she gave when she was in school. But she is, I don't know how practicing she is of her Muslim faith, but she is Iranian. And it's very interesting that he's trying to pull close to Iran. But I honestly didn't believe he was going to go through with this. I honestly believed he was just going to kind of give some, kind of a pat on the back, shake of the hand, see what happens, and knowing it was going to completely fall apart. But actually, he gave parameters. And what bothers me is, A, the parameters only deal with the nuclear program. Again, it has nothing in the peace negotiations have anything to do with Iran's terror activity around the world towards the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Or in the Middle East, unsettling the region. I just was listening to a friend of mine give a talk with the Washington Institute for Near Eastern Policy on all of the Shiite militias around the Middle East that are raising havoc in Iraq and Syria and Yemen and in Lebanon and now in the Gulf states. All have association with Iran. But we didn't talk about that.
It's not happening in Iran, though, right? Because their leadership has things pretty much.
No, they're under control.
Right.
So the other nations that I mentioned are majority Sunni. So except for Lebanon, Iraq's got a Shiite majority as well. They just don't have any power. But none of these. My point is that none of this was in those was addressed by these talks.
Right.
Secondly, there's the the talks, the agreement lines, there's been no agreement, but the points of agreement require a tremendous amount of trust for things that Iran has already broken in the past, letting inspectors come in regularly, have access to everything, etc. Right. I don't understand why we're trying to trust these guys again. It doesn't make any sense. So I really just thought President Obama was bluffing, was just trying to give a show of good faith that we're trying the diplomacy route.
Photo op.
And I was so angry, and I just could not believe it that he would actually go through with it.
So honestly, what recourse, if any, does Congress have? Do they have to ratify the treaty?
It's not a treaty. Because of the invention of the UN, President Obama, now he cannot repeal U.S. sanctions, he can just not enforce them. But as far as an international agreement, has nothing to do with the sovereignty of the United States, which is why so many people don't like the UN, because it goes around nations. Hmm. But President Obama is using the international platform to go around Congress. He doesn't, and it's not unconstitutional. That's what people need to – there were no parameters added to U.S. law for what the United States president can do, what the executive branch can do as a participant in the UN. There's no parameters. Now, that should worry a lot of people, but presidents have been able to pretty much do whatever they want through the UN without addressing Congress at all. So Congress is currently trying to pass a bill saying with a check on President Obama that he cannot agree for the U.S. to do anything in concert with the international community without their consent. But they're going to need a two-thirds majority. They're going to need to be able to override any veto. And I don't know if they have that or not.
Okay. And it seems like in the past we've pretty much always been more of the – had the upper hand within the UN. And this almost seems like President Obama has given the UN the upper hand in terms of U.S. policy.
Well, he's driving the policy through the UN.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we still have the majority – the majority thrust here. I remember when the Iran deal details came out, a lot of people were saying, well, this isn't Obama's fault. This is the P5 plus one's fault. And I said, oh, come on. Like, Obama's driving this machine. I mean, mm-hmm. They weren't even involved. But the reason why he included the P5 plus one is because he knew, as just the United States, he couldn't do anything because Congress wouldn't let him. He knew he had to have the international community as it, making this an international community initiative. He mm-hmm. knew he had to have the P5 plus one, but make no mistake, it was this is the president's initiative. This is completely his initiative.
Okay.
Do you think this is a dangerous precedent, though, that our sovereignty is migrating over to the international community?
Oh, that discussion has been around since the creation of the United Nations, and this is why so many Americans don't like it,
right.
Because the United States, the United Nations recognizes the sovereignty of no nation. If they feel like they can override your sovereignty, they will. And a lot of foreign leaders have used the United Nations to usurp their own government because they want more. They want to make a unilateral decision or an executive decision, and doing exactly what President Obama has done. This is not new, but people should really take note because our government. The executive branch is now seeking to usurp its authority, from Congress, and do things on his own.
Now it sounds like because Benjamin Netanyahu was the one that really kind of instigated the Christians United for Israel, that the Jewish people do have the same level of commitment to Christians as they're looking for from Christians to Jews. Do you think that's the case, or
first
is it
of all,
more political?
It's well, a lot of it is very political, and so Jews are not monolithic. They don't even work monolithically. They don't work together on the same stuff. But Benjamin Netanyahu is a very shrewd politician, and he knew he lived here for a very long time in the United States, knew that there were a lot of Christians that supported the state of Israel. The only problem is there was no formalizing of them. There are plenty of pro-Israel organizations, but they're all Jewish-focused. There's nothing for the non-Jewish community, and so CUFI, that's why he wanted CUFI formed. And he knew the majority of the support for Israel in our country comes from our Christian heritage. It's not inherent in anything else. It's been there for years. You ask if Harry Truman were alive and you ask him, you can even read his memoirs about why he called Ben Gurion 8 minutes after the State of Israel was declared to congratulate him. There weren't other world leaders calling Ben-Gurion. But the United States, yes, and he did it in complete opposition to the State Department, who told him, don't you dare.
Even Richard Nixon said his mother was a Bible-reading Quaker, and he remembered the stories of Israel.
Yeah.
And it prompted him to be open to
Golda Meir
in 73.
That's right. Airlifting weapons during the Yom Kippur War to keep Israel a player in that game, and they eventually won that war, barely, but they won it. They stayed alive. And the United States has been a big player. So that comes from our Christian ethic. Benjamin Netanyahu, again, very shrewd, very good understanding of United States policy, having lived here for so long. He engaged John Hagee on that basis. So there is a tremendous amount of natural love in the United States of Christians for Israel and the Jewish people. There's a lot of mistrust on the part of Jews of Christians in the United States because they've lived a very harsh and very hard hospitality from Christians traditionally. Mm-hmm. And the Holocaust, they in their mind, was perpetrated by a guy who claimed to be a Christian. So,
I think we would disagree with that amongst Christians, but
amongst Jews, you know, they're having a hard time deciding who is what. So, the same point, we have a hard time deciding what Muslims are terrorists
and
which are not. They have the same problem with looking at Christians, wondering who's going to support us and who isn't. Mm-hmm. So, but in Tucson, I can say this, and around the United States as Christians, and this is really the purpose of CUFI, is getting into the grassroots and pumping Israel back into the life stream. We're losing it amongst the younger generations, and the goal is to ensure it for the future. I'm not going to live in Israel. I'm going to live in the United States, and we want God's blessing here, and we have had it because of our support of Israel.
Okay. So, I mean, that would ask the question, well, why should Christians, especially those in the United States, be so concerned about Israel when what we talked about in the first half hour, there's hundreds of thousands of Christians being persecuted all across the world. You know, what is it specifically that we're looking as Christians in the U.S.? Why Israel? Why not our own?
Well, just to start with, Christians should lift their voices and thank Israel for protecting Christians in the Middle East. They've opened their doors to migrant Christian populations running from Syria, Iraq, and other places in the Middle East, including Lebanon, who are being persecuted. But Israel has the only growing Christian population in the Middle East.
So that's the only safe
harbor. Only safe haven for Christians in the Middle East is in Israel. That's it. I mean, and they have the largest church building. It's the Church of the Annunciation in Nazareth in the Middle East. Christians are there's actually now a Greek Orthodox priest going around Israel recruiting Christians to join the IDF. There's a major shift in Christian policy towards Israel within Israel. Before Israel, Christians lived in Israel, they had full rights and all that, but they didn't really engage militarily or politically. Now they are.
Okay.
So there's Christians have a lot to be appreciative of.
So what does it take to get involved here
Go
in Tucson?
Go to CUFI.org or TucsonLovesIsrael.org. You can email me at TucsonLovesIsrael@gmail.com if you have any other questions, but we can get you engaged in your church, whatever, what part of the community you're in.
Okay, and again, the event on Tuesday, you want to give us the details on that?
7 o'clock, doors open at 6:30 for seating. Dennis Prager is going to be our keynote speaker. You will not want to miss it.
He is, oh, not
there
at
is
all.
Very few people who can speak with his eloquence and authority on the necessity of Christians supporting Israel and Jewish-Christian relations.
Appreciate it, John.
Fox Theater, downtown Tucson.
Thank you very much. That's pretty much it for Solomon on Blast. Until next week, think wisely.